state and federal politics in the papers by this time, probably Sunday. We're going to have to leave it there. ABC writer and presenter Annabelle Crabb and lead partner at Deloitte Integrity and adjunct professor of law at Newcastle University. It's Dean Sanders. Great to have you both. Have a nice weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you too.
And thanks to the team behind the scenes, Katie Heyman, Claire O'Halloran, Grace Stranger, Flint Duxfield, Nancy Knotson, Madeline Grummett, Scott Wales and Lachlan Orr, and the studio engineers that helped me get you the nation's live conversation across the day's politics, current affairs and culture on ABC Radio National Drive each weekday afternoon from 4. I'm Andy Park. Have a nice weekend. Bye for now.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, Queensland goes to the polls tomorrow. After early predictions of a wipeout for Labor, the race tightens in the final stretch. Also, the King makes a grim warning about climate change. And are you a fan of horror films? The genre is enjoying success at the box office this year. What is it that keeps audiences coming back for more?
I think what's really great about horror as a genre is it allows us to sort of like hold a mirror up to society and sort of reflect all the anxieties and stresses and things that are kind of on our minds. But you get to also walk out of the theater and go about your life afterwards.
First tonight, for more than a year, the winds of change have been blowing in Queensland politics and polls have pointed to a Labor wipeout at the ballot box. But with just hours to go until Election Day, the opposition's lead appears to have narrowed. Hot-button issues like abortion and tackling youth crime are proving divisive, while cost of living, housing and health remain key policy touchpoints. Catherine Gregory reports.
For these far north Queenslanders, the high rate of crime in Cairns is the top issue in this weekend's state election.
The key thing here is the crime. It's putting the tourism off. It's affecting people coming into state, I think into Cairns, and I think it's going to lower investment into Cairns. So it needs to be addressed, and it doesn't need to be done locally. It needs to be taken out of Cairns, literally out of Cairns.
This man has just cast his vote for the Liberal National Party, hoping if it wins government, it'll crack down hard on youth crime. It's the same for this voter.
I don't think Labor's doing enough for the region and for crime.
He thinks the LNP would do a better job.
They're traditionally a bit harder, a little bit more unforgiving, and I think that's what we need.
LNP leader David Crisafulli, who's hoping to get his party back into power after 9 years in opposition, has campaigned heavily on Queensland's youth crime crisis. He's promising to introduce adult time for young offenders who commit serious offences like murder, manslaughter, serious assault and grievous bodily harm. He'd also introduce isolation for inmates who assault staff at youth detention centres. Labor Premier Stephen Miles says this approach won't prevent crime and is more focused on better resourcing for police. For this voter in Cairns, Labor is the better option.
Because I think they're for the working man.
Labor's held the seat of Cairns since 1904, but some voters are keen for a change, particularly given Labor's links to the embattled unions.
I voted Cattle Party and then One Nation after that. Oh, I'm sick of the Uniparty, really. Yeah, just want a bit of change.
Labor's tipped to struggle the most in regional Queensland, particularly in the seats of Mackay, Townsville, Bundaberg and Rockhampton, where the minor parties could be a roadblock for both Labor and the LNP. But in Brisbane, Labor could have a better chance, particularly with young people like this woman.
I've seen a lot of things on, like, TikTok and, like, just, like, talking to my friends as well helped me decide what to vote. I think I like how much, like, Stephen Miles is, like, trying to, like, help, like, the younger generation as well. He's, like, the 50 Cent Fairs. The whole policy is, like, abortion and that kind of... It really aligns with, like, my beliefs as well.
Abortion is a heated topic in this election. It emerged after Robbie Katter, the leader of Katter's Australia Party, vowed to introduce a private member's bill to wind back abortion rights. If he does that, there's speculation it could spark a conscience vote in the parliament. The LNP, while saying there'd be no changes to abortion laws, hasn't given a clear response about whether it would allow its MPs a conscience vote. It's an issue which some analysts and Labor say explains why polls show that Labor is catching up to the LNP now, which had been the front runner the entire campaign. Here's Premier Stephen Miles.
Well, I think what we've seen is a continuing trend across the polls that as Queenslanders get more of a chance to see and learn about David Crisafulli, the more questions they have, the less they like him.
The news poll conducted for The Australian this past week shows that on a two-party preferred result, 52.5% of the 1,151 people surveyed want an LNP government, while 47.5% want Labor. It's narrower than at the start of the election campaign. Stephen Miles' message to Queenslanders today as he tours 36 seats in 36 hours is that change is risk.
Change comes with risks to people's jobs, cuts to services, and risk to women's reproductive rights.
David Crisafulli has urged voters to give the LNP a chance, saying Queensland is ready for a change.
The Labor Party have run a scare campaign and the unions have backed them up, but we haven't wavered from giving Queenslanders hope over that fear. And I'm asking Queenslanders, if you don't want to see a fourth term, 14 years from the Labor Party, if you don't want to see a minority parliament with the Greens and CADA, it would be bedlam, chaos, and we're offering stability.
Associate Professor Paul Williams from Griffith University says of all the state election campaigns he's seen, this one is the most unusual. That's because while Labor probably won't win, it's edging closer.
It's had three terms. We're struggling to look at a fourth. Queensland's in the grip of not only cost of living, which is affecting all Australians, but also youth crime, hospital ramping, what people think is a shambolic rollout of Olympic infrastructure, social housing and a range of other issues. You'd think that the government and the Premier would have given up the ghost. So the most remarkable thing is that a government that looked done and dusted could actually turn it around, not to the point of winning, but certainly to scare the LNP.
Associate Professor Paul Williams ending that report by Catherine Gregory. King Charles has issued a stark warning on climate change to leaders at the opening of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa. Charles, who's been a long-time environmental advocate, says climate change risks not just environmental catastrophe, but could also widen the gap between wealthy and developing nations. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has arrived at the meeting and has defended Australia's performance in tackling climate change, but he's likely to come under pressure from Pacific leaders. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts is at the summit. Stephen, what was the King's tone when he made that address?
Look, Rachel, the King's tone was honestly a pretty grim one. Now, Charles, of course, has long been an advocate for action on the environment and on climate change. He has curbed or moderated his tone a little bit, understandably, since he ascended the throne, partly because of his constitutional role and responsibilities. But his message today was still a very, very stark one. The King was keen to point out that climate change didn't just present environmental threats, but also threats to the economies and the livelihoods of Commonwealth countries. And he warned that the fact that so many countries are now being hit with these cascading sets of natural disasters that we've seen, for example, this year in Africa, made it harder and harder for them to get out of debt and harder for them to catch up with developed and wealthy nations. As he put it, it could continually drive a wedge between developed and developing countries, making global inequality even more pronounced. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Lives, livelihoods, and human rights are at risk across the Commonwealth. I can only offer every encouragement for action with unequivocal determination to arrest rising temperatures by cutting emissions, building resilience as far as possible to both the current and forecast impacts of climate change, and conserving and restoring nature both on land and in the sea.
That's, of course, the voice of King Charles there. Stephen, Australia's coming under some fire for what critics at the summit consider to be slow action on climate change. What have those criticisms been, and what's the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese had to say?
look, the main criticisms have focused not on what Australia's doing with its domestic emissions and domestic climate change policies, but more on what it's doing with its exports. Pacific leaders have acknowledged that Australia is making progress towards decarbonisation. Yes, it's probably slower than they'd like, but they acknowledge the government is trying to drive down towards net zero. The real point of conflict that is emerging is over Australia's fossil fuel exports and the fact that Australia is continuing to expand production of coal and gas exports to other countries. Now, the response from the government has been that in the end, they can't take responsibility for the decisions other governments make when they purchase Australian coal and gas. As the Foreign Minister Penny Wong said yesterday, in the end, they're decisions that developing countries are taking. But that argument doesn't always cut it with Pacific leaders who are increasingly frustrated by the way that the expansion of these industries is potentially putting their livelihoods at risk. Now, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, he was asked about some of these criticisms, particularly from Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Feleti Teo. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Well, I had positive discussions with Prime Minister Teo and other Pacific leaders here. They recognise that the challenge of climate change doesn't mean that you can just flick a switch and act immediately. We need to make sure that energy security is prioritised in order to make sure that we have that support going forward. The feedback I've had from Pacific leaders has been very welcoming of Australia's leadership here in the Pacific when it comes to climate action.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, and before that, the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. While the federal coalition here in Australia is pushing to build 7 nuclear power plants around the country, Taiwan is working to phase theirs out. The island's that nuclear reactor is due to be decommissioned next year, amid fears over earthquakes and how to dispose of waste. But Taiwan imports nearly all of its energy, most of which is fossil fuels, and those advocating for nuclear to stay say it's essential for energy security as it faces down threats from China. Our East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood filed this report from Taiwan. Shaman Umrush is harvesting taro from a waterlogged field on Lanyu, also known as Orchid Island, in southwest Taiwan.
This is the field I inherited from my parents. These fields have been here for generations.
The island has been at the heart of Taiwan's nuclear debate since the 80s when the government built a nuclear waste site on Lanyu. With this special connection to the land and as the local school principal, Shaman Umrush has been pushing to have it removed.
Once we learned that it was nuclear waste, we started protesting. It has been nearly 40 years now.
The nuclear waste stored on Lanyu is low level, but investigations have found several cases of mismanagement, potentially exposing workers to high levels of radiation. Although electricity company Taipower says radiation around the dump is within safe limits. Shaman Umrush still worries about its impact on the environment.
If the nuclear waste stays in Lanyu, it will impact the roots of the plants and the habits of the animals.
In the aftermath of the 2011 Fukushima disaster in Japan, the public in Taiwan, which also experiences frequent earthquakes, voted against firing up a new nuclear plant. And so the Taiwanese government continued with plans to wind down all 3 other nuclear power plants. The final reactor is due to be shut down in the next 6 months, and clean energy advocate Angelica Ong says there have been consequences to the move.
To take all that power you expected off the grid, it's left everything just really, really tight. Since I started covering energy in Taiwan from 2020, we've had 3 island-wide multi-hour rolling blackouts. And that should be absolutely unacceptable, especially in a country where there's so much high tech.
Taiwan produces 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductor chips, which are in everything from smartphones and cars to military technology. Taiwan now mainly relies on coal and gas, and 97% of energy sources are imported. So a blockade or invasion by China could put the island's energy under pressure very quickly, and that could have consequences that reach well outside of Taiwan. Here's Angelica Ung again.
Because the amount of nuclear, even if we turn on all our legacy reactors, is still going to be relatively low. But all that fuel is stored on site routinely. 18 months worth of fuel is stored on a nuclear power plant, and you can make it more. In a wartime situation, that little bit of power you can rely on not to run out could make or break Taiwan's future.
But Tsai-Ing Lu from government think tank the Research Institute for Democracy, Society and Emerging Technology says Taiwan needs to look elsewhere for that security.
I think Taiwan needs to do more works on how to push to more renewable energy and to make them integrated into the grid.
With only 9% of Taiwan's energy coming from renewables, the pressure is on to build up that safety net.
East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe made her request to the King abundantly clear earlier this week. At a reception in Canberra, Senator Thorpe shouted at King Charles, "Give us a treaty. We want a treaty in this country." Her protest ignited debate on a number of fronts and prompted questions about the need for a treaty with Australia's Indigenous people. As they struggle with rising poverty, health problems and youth incarceration, what do Indigenous leaders and residents of a remote Northern Territory community think about a treaty? Jane Barden filed this report.
On the bank of the MacArthur River, 11 hours drive southeast of Darwin, Borroloola has a multi-million dollar zinc mine on its doorstep, but many of its 900 mostly Indigenous residents live in poverty. Grandmother Dina Britcher-Gundy is worried about families struggling to afford groceries and regularly has to feed several neighbours' kids.
It breaks my heart to see little kids, you know, going from house to house looking for food.
She saw Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe tell King Charles in Parliament this week she wants a treaty, and she couldn't agree more.
Give us a treaty! We want a treaty in this country!
Dina Britcher-Gundy thinks a treaty is needed because it could give Indigenous communities more power to improve their lives.
It's been a long time waiting on that to come, so it's got to happen sooner or later. Yeah, to make sure we have a voice in it.
The state treaty processes, which have been started by Victoria and Queensland, are offering elements including enabling Indigenous people to govern themselves and financial compensation for colonisation. Also in Borroloola, Joyce Durdy works in a support service trying to help families keep their kids out of child protection. She's worried many people are dependent on welfare, many young people are going into prison, and poorly maintained roads are wrecking the community's cars.
The roads are really not good. It's got potholes everywhere.
She wants a treaty because she's fed up with successive governments making promises to improve Indigenous lives that they don't keep. Would a treaty within Australia's Indigenous people be important, or it's not?
I think so.
What would it mean to you?
It would mean that we'd make decisions too, you know, on the table, like in the old days. Elders would sit down with everyone and make decisions. It was really good, not this one, change, vote, nah.
Borroloola Garawa leader and traditional owner Keith Rory has the same view.
We've been promised from both government, both party, or we will help you and we will try to get some money in, but nothing happened.
He thinks a treaty could change that.
I think treaty is important, you know, like we've been struggling and fighting for our lives, you know, to get a better deal from a better government, but it just doesn't happen.
Garawa elder Jack Green feels governments aren't doing enough to stop chronic illness rates worsening and local health services are thin.
One main thing we need to look at that how people are getting sick and why. Then we need a proper doctor that they stand here all the time.
You haven't got a full-time doctor?
No, I just come and go doctor.
He says a treaty is needed because currently Indigenous people are at the whim of government policy, which chops and changes as administrations come and go.
Well, I think we still doesn't have a proper relationship with government properly. You know, we're still in there. We don't know what they're doing.
For you, would it be useful to have a treaty?
I think it's important so we can get recognised a bit more better, you know. I want them to take it back and push a bit harder for it, you know. Try and get us recognised, the Aboriginal people. They keep pushing us back in the backyard sort of thing. Yeah.
Working towards a national treaty was one of Federal Labor's election commitments. Asked if the government still wants a treaty, Federal Indigenous Australians Minister Mulindiri McCarthy suggested moving towards that would be too divisive. She's leaving it for states and territories to go down that path.
Well, we've seen what's happened in the states in terms of their push for treaty and truth-telling, and so I commend them and encourage them to keep doing the work, especially given what we saw with the referendum and the weaponisation of Indigenous issues. I certainly don't want to see that happen again on a national scale.
Are people just going to have to accept there won't be much movement on treaty?
Well, I'd certainly say to the people of Australia that I would not want to see the weaponisation of Indigenous issues that I saw throughout the referendum. Now, we've got plans and we want to help elevate people from the poverty that they're experiencing across our country, and we'll continue to do that.
The Coalition's Indigenous Australians spokeswoman Jacinta Namba-Jimba-Price didn't respond to an interview request, but has opposed a treaty, arguing it wouldn't deliver on-the-ground benefits. Borroloola resident Dina Britcher-Gundy doesn't agree.
Because we've been living under the Commonwealth Government for that bloody long now, and it's just too much now for everybody to take. I think we need to, have our say now, input into everything, what happens in the community, especially in our own communities.
Borroloola resident Dina Britcher-Gundy talking there to Jane Barden. How would you like to live alone on a remote island for 6 months a year? A lot of people probably couldn't hack the solitude, but life on Gabo Island off the easternmost tip of Victoria promises a way of life that Sandy Duthie couldn't wait to pursue. He's just taken over from the outgoing caretaker of the island and lighthouse, who's finishing up after 25 years. Fiona Broom headed to Gabo Island to learn more.
And there was a little hut over here where they used to store the supplies in.
Leo Obden-Brow has spent half of the past 25 years alone on a remote island.
I'm only one page in a 150-year-old history book.
He's part of a 160-year legacy of Gabo Island's lighthouse keepers. The island, off Victoria's easternmost point, is surrounded by little penguins, sea eagles and shearwaters, and the rough sea teems with whales, seals and dolphins.
Being here, you're in such a wild environment that's natural. That what we see here, the only changes that have happened out here in the last 1,000 years is Europeans have showed up, put in navigational aids for their mariners. Some people would say it's an intrusion on the landscape because it's a man-made structure on a really natural wild environment. But on the other hand, it serves a really important purpose, keeping mariners safe and, you know, guiding beacon to home. Sort of, you know, there's a lot of romanticism and tradition around lighthouses.
As we sit on the veranda of the keeper's cottage on Gabo Island, a pod of whales breaches in front of us and Leo points out a kestrel he's known for years. But it hasn't all been moon-gazing and serenity. Caretakers keep meticulous weather records for the Bureau of Meteorology while being responsible for all 154 hectares on the island.
For a long time, we had the largest known little penguin colony in Australia. That's changed in recent years. No one's quite sure why. I've seen the whale numbers increase significantly. Now, when I was the first few years I was out here, if we saw a whale, it was very exciting and I'd run around and watch it. And, you know, and I see them breaching, I see them feeding their calves. I've seen them only 20 metres from the shore.
Being so isolated would challenge many of us. Now there's intermittent mobile phone service, but for most of his career on Gabo Island, it was just Leo and his thoughts. But he sees that time and space as a privilege.
That's why I keep coming back. You know, I'm sort of quite happy to be in my own company, and keeping occupied and busy is never hard because there's 101 duties to do to maintain the light station and the environment.
There's a whale there.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, we saw that coming over.
There it goes again.
Help out while I
I'll go and do the weather.
Yeah.
Leo has handed the keys to the lighthouse to Sandy Duthie. An arborist for 20 years in Scotland, Sandy visited Gabo Island a few years ago to manage invasive weeds and dreamed of one day becoming caretaker. He's done a few shifts now, so how does it feel to be alone on an island for 6 weeks?
It's pretty good. It can get lonely in those times, but most of the time it's pretty good. I really like the fact that there's a lot of environmental work that we do here. It's nice to get away from technology, to not have phone signal. We have to do weather reports every 6 hours, 9 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, 9 at night, 3 in the morning. That keeps you super present.
Sandy says he's learning to tune in to the rhythm of the island, but when his rotation ends, he swaps out with the other lighthouse keeper.
I also get a month at home when I don't have many responsibilities or different responsibilities, so I have time to reflect on my time here and get excited about coming back again.
Being an island caretaker is an awesome responsibility, one that Sandy doesn't take lightly.
I love the history. The previous caretakers have got so much knowledge on it, and I'm trying to absorb it from them when I get a chance. I see it as being, we're caretakers of this island. We're here to look after it and try and preserve what the island's all about.
For Leo, saying goodbye to his life on Gabo Island isn't easy, but he's looking forwards and hopes more people get the chance to visit the place he loves.
Once you've spent quite a bit of time here, it sort of gets into your soul. It just becomes part of who you are. The island belongs to all Australians. It belongs to everybody. And looking into the future, I really would like to see it remain as accessible to the average person, not the high-yield tourist, but the average person who wants to get out and make the most of the country that they're a part of. Whether that happens or not, we'll just have to wait and see.
Leo Opdenbrow, the retiring caretaker on Gabo Island, ending that report by Fiona Broom. Horror films. Some people love them, some people are too scared to watch them. And right now, the genre is enjoying a lot of success at the box office. That might come as a bit of a surprise. What is it about horror movies that keep drawing audiences in? Twi Ong Fitzpatrick reports.
I have to go back to the Terrifier.
Horror films have had a big year in 2024. There was Terrifier 3, a low-budget movie about an evil axe-wielding clown, which at one point rose to the top of the US box office, beating other much more expensive Hollywood heavyweights.
I need you to listen to me.
Then there was Smile 2.
Something really bad happened.
The story of a pop star haunted by disturbing visions of people smiling. That one topped the box office in its first week. Smile 2's director is Parker Finn.
I think what's really great about horror as a genre is it allows us to sort of like hold a mirror up to society and sort of reflect all the sort of collective anxieties and stresses and things that are kind of on our minds.
His first movie, the original Smile, became 2022's highest grossing horror film, making over $320 million at the box office. Parker Finn thinks audiences are relishing being terrorised again.
Well, I think that the best horror can be really cathartic. I think it's a really, exciting experience, even if it's terrifying or if it's bleak or it's, you know, sticks with you and gets under your skin and creeps you out. There's something about the experience of going through a human, going through something that I think it allows us, it's almost like a roller coaster where you get to experience the danger, the intensity, but you get to also walk out of the theater and go about your life afterwards, hopefully a little changed.
Do you feel like it's also a bit of a communal experience?
Absolutely. I think that communal experience of sitting in the dark with like hundreds of other strangers who are in the same mood, same like mindedness as you, and you're all screaming and jumping and laughing or going silent at the same time. I just think there's nothing else like it.
Halloween night.
Classic horror films like Halloween and Rosemary's Baby have always attracted those with a morbid fascination. And that tradition's continued with more modern movies like 2022 Australian film Talk to Me, which was shot in Adelaide.
Put your hand on it. Now say, talk to me.
But 2023 saw a big jump. Admissions to horror movies soared to more than 3 million in Australia. That's a 49% year-on-year increase, according to Val Morgan, which specialises in cinema advertising. Horror also consistently ranks among the top genres for Gen Z globally. So why are audiences so keen to be scared? David Lorenzini is the co-organiser of the Melbourne Horror Film Society, which runs regular screenings of cult and popular horror films.
Going to the cinema or your lounge room, depending on how you're watching things, it's a safe space to release your darkest thoughts without actually hurting anyone in real life.
Horror films have often thrived at times when society is going through moments of great anxiety. Monster movies like King Kong and Frankenstein were made in the early 1930s, a period that coincides with the Great Depression, while Jordan Peele's Get Out, released in 2017, has been described by some as a mirror to race relations during the Trump presidency.
People sort of chase, you know, they get enjoyment out of the fear, because it's a fear that can't hurt you. And I know that was definitely, you know, I was a very scared little boy. And, you know, then able to sort of watch these things that were making me scared, but it was like I was in control of the scares or the fear, because I could either look away or I could stop it. But I was fascinated. I enjoyed that fear. And I think a lot of other people do as well.
And it's clear audiences are lapping up horror films. Smile 2 is already in the top 50 films for 2024, taking in $75 million after just a week of release.
Twi Ong Fitzpatrick reporting there for us. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by David Sargent, Lena Elsadi, Nick Draculis, Joram Toth and Mark Cash. I'm Rachel Mealy. Thanks for your company this week. Good night.
Sarah Hall with ABC News. King Charles admits the Commonwealth should acknowledge its painful history amid calls for reparations to countries affected by the slave trade. Some leaders are using the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa to call on Britain to apologise for its role in order to begin the reparations process. The British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, concedes the slave trade was abhorrent.
You know, we recognise that, and of course apologies have already been made in relation to the slave trade, and that's not surprising, it's what you would expect. You know, we're 55 countries here represented, and say in the conversations I've already had, what are the things that have come up most, particularly with some of the smaller countries, about the impact of climate on them.
Hamas is signalling it's ready to negotiate again over ceasefire terms if Israel agrees to halt its invasion of Gaza. John O'Wakely reports.
Qatar will host Israeli and Hamas officials from Sunday to negotiate a possible ceasefire and hostage deal, with Egyptian and US mediators travelling to Doha to join the talks. The US says the recent death of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar may open the door for negotiations to allow civilians on both sides to return home.